I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Real Spoilers, powered by ReviewSTL.com.
Warning, the following film discussion will ruin the ending of any movie you haven't seen. Example, Bruce Willis is dead at the end of The Sixth Sense. See how I ruined it for you? Just like that. Here are a few more.
Silent breed is people!
I am the father.
Get it?
Real Spoilers. You've been warned.
Broadcasting from the lush but not lavish studios located in the basement of the O'Keefe Institute for Advanced Film Snarkitude, this is Real Spoilers, episode 601, a true milestone.
Milestone, yes, right.
Truly.
Truly.
Truly, truly.
So this episode, a little different.
I'm going to wake myself up, sorry.
Oh, good morning.
Just in case I fell asleep.
Please silence all your phones. That goes
yeah, no kidding.
When you're at the movies and when you're at the movie podcast.
Exactly.
So this episode is going to be a little different. We're going to tackle Bill and Ted 1 and 2 in the same episode. So they're not super plot intensive. So before we do all that, let's go around the virtual table and everyone can introduce themselves.
This is Joe.
This is Kevin.
And this is Tom. Quick shameless plugs. Don't forget we're available wherever you get your podcasts. Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts.
Zoom.
Is that even still around?
I don't know.
They
I still
leave
have
stuff
one.
Up.
We gotta ask Timmy.
Yeah, they leave stuff up forever. So like maybe it is. I don't know. But
you have to have Windows 98 yeah. Second Edition to listen to it.
And what? Oh, and while you're at your desired podcast delivery service, be sure and subscribe so you never miss an episode. You could also leave a review if you'd be so kind, and you could also share an episode through Facebook or Twitter. That's always helpful. People who were kind enough to share the episode this week: Aaron Marlowe, Julianne Jordan, Chris Williams, Chris Magic Man, Ralph Tribble, Gabriel Lugo, Tammy Sherman Powers, Michael Dean, Matt Naglia, Ronnie Castle, and Ryan Terry. And you can also check out our Facebook page, facebook.com/realspoilers. While you're there, like the page, join the group, and don't forget our Patreon, patreon.com/realspoilers, where for $5 a month you get access to all sorts of bonus content, and you help us out, and that is greatly appreciated. So there is all that. Bill and Ted, this is a long time between sequels.
Yeah. Which one? Between two and
well,
the
no,
last
there was
one,
no
or?
Time between one and two, because that's, you know,
right.
the 2 years, 89
and 91.
Right. That's appropriate, but 29 years. I mean, I know I'm getting out ahead of ourselves a little bit, but we're talking about Bill and Ted because we're going to talk about two, and I think that the idea that a sequel 29 years later, that's...
I think it's just there's just like this rush of nostalgia for 80s kids.
Yeah.
Right, so there was the Jay and Silent Bob reboot.
Yeah, but he's never really let that die.
Well, but I mean, like he went, but it's been a while. Like Clerks 2 was kind of the last time we saw any of those characters. But there has been like this another wave of nostalgia movies, and Bill and Ted is right in that wheelhouse for me. Like I adore that this first movie. Like yeah. I love the first movie. But they've had comic books and cartoons. Like, they were the quintessential 80s property that they yeah. milked as hard as they could.
This movie's awesome. This first Bill and Ted is really great. The concept is clever. It's funny. The jokes are good. It's a very, for as quote-unquote dumb as the two of them are, the movie's very smart in the way that they are written, because it's hard to write characters that are not the brightest but have it be really funny, right? It could come off as stupid comedy and just not interesting.
What makes all three of them work? Because I gotta say, going, I hadn't seen Bogus Journey since it came out.
What
know?
A wackadoo movie that is!
Yeah,
in the
totally.
Best way. Like it's just
yeah,
so crazy.
I remember walking out of Bogus Journey and being like, "Meh," and revisiting it, I liked it way more than I remembered. Even
yes.
though it does end up really recycling a lot of the first movie, which is I'm sure what I didn't like about it. But I think what it comes down to is these two characters are so sweet, you know, like they're
yes.
they're just really sweet, innocent, genuinely nice people. And I thought it was interesting that in both movies, because, you know, I hadn't seen them since the 90s. Like I've never really
sure.
revisited these. Like I didn't have a lot of love for these movies. Like I watched them and they were fine and I enjoyed them, but I didn't like embrace them in the same way I might have a Back to the Future or something, right? And
right. Like I didn't have either of these on repeat like you, where I enjoyed them. I saw them. I own both the DVDs, which is how I watched the second one, because there was nowhere without paying for it to watch it. So I'm like, well, I'm not going to buy. I don't need to buy Bogus Journey. So I watched my DVD.
Yeah, I bought Bogus Journey for like, it was on sale on Vudu for like $5 one day. And I'm like, at some point I want to watch this again. And then I already.
Yeah,
it's
$15 now. So that's
yeah,
why I didn't like.
Totally. like these guys are super innocent and sweet. And going back and watching this movie with a modern eye, I was like, is this going to be cringe inducing? And there's only one thing that really
yeah.
caught my eye that I thought was cringe inducing. Interestingly enough, it does happen in both movies, but the
it does.
But the use
I know exactly
of,
what you're talking
of
about.
The other F word.
Yes.
For the,
I only noticed it in the second one.
They
say in the first one.
They say in the first one as well.
Because there's a moment where they're in grave danger and then they get saved and they hug each other. And then they break apart and they have their moment of homosexual panic, quote unquote.
Yeah, right, right. Oh, we can't be touchy feely. We're dudes.
Totally.
It is very hard to hear that type of stuff because we're just like nowadays. You're like, that's not funny in the slightest.
A friend of mine said she's like, she's got a son who's seven or eight. And she was like, oh, I've never watched these. And I was like, oh, man, like, this is perfect. And I'm like, there is one time that maybe you have to explain a word. But overall, like, yeah. There's nothing in these movies. The second one I put on, did anybody else see Return to Oz?
Year, I mean,
yeah,
35 years ago.
That is a crazy movie.
Yeah, it's
like,
wacky.
I put Bill and Ted 2 on the level of Return to Oz. Because they just went for it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, they, you know, I can't believe that a studio was like, yeah, go ahead. Pull the faces off your main characters to reveal a gnarly robot. Like,
well,
that's okay.
Well, two things to those points. So I think the reason, going back to what Tom said about the characters, you're right, and I wholeheartedly agree. Though characters are such good people, they never, the real Bill and Ted, they never put them through really an existential crisis where they start acting poorly and they have to, or they don't break, they don't hate each other and they have to become friends again, which has become a huge trope, obviously, with buddy movies.
Sure.
They don't ever make them do bad things and then they have to recover from it or whatnot. They're genuinely nice, sweet characters, like you said. And I think what that comes down to is the creators and the original writers, Chris Matheson and Ed Solomon, wrote all three of these movies. So their writing style and the way they crafted these characters has carried through, and they've been able to see their vision through all the way to this, you know, this new one, 31 years later after they did the original. And so the characters are genuinely sweet people. And then when you talk about just going for it, Joe, I mean, so the original movie was basically, and as I watch it again, you can totally notice it feels like an indie movie or like an art house movie,
like
the equivalent.
And it feels like a cartoon. Indie movie. Like,
but the original
right.
feels like the equivalent of an art house movie today. And the movie, although back then it was more money, but it only had a budget of $6.5 million, and it made $40.5 million. So when that second one came around, they did say, go for it. And
yeah, I guess that's fair.
And the problem is that it is so weird
that they
and
went
crazy.
For it.
and, you know, the audiences weren't ready for it
yeah.
because
no,
it's just
no.
too crazy. Like, looking back now, you're like, oh, this is weird, but it's in a cool kind of way. But back then, people were like, wait a minute, what? Like, the whole first premise was them time traveling through different eras, and they don't even do that in the second movie. So I think people are like, what the hell? Like, I came for wacky time travel historical adventures, right?
Yeah, and just, so they get rubber-faced robots.
And just so you know, the $6.5 million budget adjusted for inflation is $13.5 million today. The second movie, The Comeback, it has a $20 million budget.
Jeez.
So like they really like they up the ante.
That would probably be like a $50 million budget today.
It is a $38 million budget today.
And, but a $13 million budget is still extremely.
It's a Blumhouse. It's a Blumhouse movie.
I mean, yeah, Blumhouse does $10 million movies.
Right.
So it really, that's why it feels like that. And I like it. I like the first one. I think the first one is I'm not trying to, pun intended.
No, no, I get it.
Really,
it's radical. I get it.
And while we're talking numbers, so the second one had a box office of $38 million. So it actually, it grossed essentially the same amount of money as the first one, but it cost, you know, three times as much money to make. Interestingly enough, the movie we'll be talking about on the next episode, Bill and Ted Face the Music, the budget for that movie?
$13 million.
$25 million. So it costs $5 million more than the second movie 30 years later.
Right.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's we've said this before, is that movies like this don't need $80 million.
It doesn't, but here's the deal. That budget also tells me that Keanu Reeves did this because he wanted to.
Yes.
And I think
need money.
Right. And I think we'll get to this in the second one. I think his performance shows you he did it because he wanted to. I mean, he is all in and having a great time. But
that is the only it is jarring in the third one.
A little
bit. Just because we so like Alex, I feel like they thought Alex
Let's wait
Winter,
for the third one. We had two
well, I mean,
movies
I mean
to talk
for one
about.
And two. I feel like one and two, at least for one, Keanu Reeves wasn't a star yet. Mm-hmm. Alex Winter had been in Lost Boys. He'd been in all kinds of stuff. So I feel like they were centering that movie around Alex Winter, and then they got Keanu Reeves. And they're just like, oh, we've made a mistake. Or we need to pivot and go to this fresh-faced surfer kid who went on to have... I think Alex Winter got behind the camera. I think that's what he ended up doing.
He does documentaries.
He does a lot of like behind
He's
the camera
director.
Stuff where Keanu was like, no, I'm...
He was directing music videos and, you know, he directed... it's interesting, on the first movie, there's a song from Extreme called...
Yeah.
Do You Want to Play? Come on and Play, something like that. It's a great song. But and then their next video, Decadence Dance, he directed.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's fun. And then in the second one, when I forgot that, was it the second one where the guy from Faith No More shows up?
Yes.
Yeah. When I was like, wow, okay, they are right in the middle of the 90s. We're in the very early 90s.
Yeah, that brief moment in time when people thought we would recognize someone from Faith No More.
Faith No More.
Yeah, oh, my gosh. Yeah, that was lost on me. I'm like, who is this guy?
You know the song Epic?
I don't.
Well,
know
you would know it. You would if you know.
They don't
it.
Really
I mean.
Say
yeah,
"epic" in the song. The hook is the what you
what
wanted.
Is, what is this?
You want it all, but you can't have it. And then
what is
this?
What is it?
Yeah. I'm sure I do. Yeah,
but yeah. So this, I mean, it's very much a lighthearted. The first one is very much a lighthearted movie about two rock and roll kids who want to start a band, but they're failing their history class and they can't. Get out in front of themselves to make this class happen, or to get the A that they need to get Ted out of going to military school, which I think is hilarious that it comes back in every. Did it come back in the third one? No, but at least in one and two, it is a recurring thing where they're going to send Ted to Alaska for military academy, and so they're down on their luck and they don't know what to do. And then they are greeted by Rufus, played by the legendary George Carlin, who I was like, yeah, man, like I miss that guy so much.
It's great
like,
to see George Carlin.
I wish he were still alive just so he could see today and he'd have material forever.
Yeah.
Like if there's anybody I'd want to hear political material of today is George Carlin.
I just wish he had more to do in this movie.
Yeah.
I was thinking that in the first two movies, they probably filmed his scenes in a day.
And he's
not in the movies a lot.
he's front and center with his stand-up career at this point. Like, he's a megastar, right?
Oh, yeah, at this point, he's a legend, but even in 87, because he'd been doing stand-up since the 60s. So,
right.
And his really legendary stuff, you know, the seven words you can't say on TV, and that's from the 70s. But he also never really, he was one, like Richard Pryor, he's one of those stand-ups who was a legendary stand-up, but never really found that kind of career-defining film role.
Sure,
You know, I mean, Richard Pryor was in a lot of movies, and some of them even, you know, were hits maybe, but he never really had that role that really fit his comic persona in the same way that, like, Robin Williams had. Good Morning Vietnam, or Eddie Murphy, or Becoming. Yeah, totally. Like, it's so I don't know. It's just he always struggled with that. He briefly had a TV show around this time for, I think,
Thomas the Tank Engine.
Yeah, in the early 90s. So he did a lot of kind of, like, you know, he would do stuff like Thomas the Tank Engine that you'd be like, okay, but.
Or what was he in? He was in Jay and Bob Strike Back, wasn't he?
Yeah, I mean, because he was in their...
he was in Dogma.
He was in Dogma.
Because he was in Dogma. He brought him back for, like, the cameo-type role, like, with all the different people from his movies. But what I really found interesting was he bookends these movies. I, you know, remembering it, I was thinking that maybe he was involved with more of the adventures or the journeys, and... When rewatching these, I'm like, oh wow, he really just sets them up and he's there at the end. And in the second one, he's even in less of it and then sets them up and then you don't see him and then he comes back at the very end. So, I mean, he's a great part of these movies and it's great to see him again, but it's interesting that going back, like, I had remembered him being in more of the movies.
Which, I mean, I don't know. I guess I feel like his brand of comedy doesn't really lend itself to. A PG movie, you know?
Oh.
So, like, getting him in neither those little did, spots.
Neither do Robin Williams, Bob Saget, Eddie
Murphy.
Yeah,
there's a lot of
kids'
movies.
Yeah, that's true. That's fair.
It's been kind of lost to time, but, like, Buddy Hackett's stand-up? Like, oof. Yeah. Like, I saw Buddy Hackett when I was a kid. And,
oh, really?
And that is not an adorable seal, I'll tell you that. Like, it's raunchy. Like,
interesting. Like,
yeah, the comedy doesn't matter for actors that comedians that go on to be actors. But I get that it's not like the stories necessarily necessitate him. It's just that he's such a great comedian that we know and love. And I'd missed him like you did. And I'm just like, oh, I kind of wanted to see more of George Carlin just because he's so great. But anyway, but yeah, I mean, he sets them on their way. And the gist of it is that like Joe said, if they don't get an A or an A+ on their history exam,
like, well, that's intense.
They're going to flunk. Like, they cannot pass without an A+, and they don't know anything about history. And you get the great scene. I mean, we talked about the clever writing, but in the history class where we learn about them failing, there's like, they're asking them about different things. Like, they're asking, who is Joan of Arc? And he says, know his wife. And, and he says, he asks Ted to talk about things. And he says that Socrates, he pronounces it Socrates. And there are so many lines that are clever. And again, it's that writing for characters that aren't the smartest or the most educated, but the jokes are clever and they land, they're coming fast and furious. And it's such a funny, well-written movie. I absolutely adore this first one. I just watched it maybe a month ago or less than that with Katie.
For the first time. Oh.
And then I watched it again, which I wasn't paying as close of attention because I just watched it. But I watched it again here just a couple days ago. And it's like, it's one that I didn't find it on DVD on rewatch, like, you know, play it on a loop. But
I think I saw this in theaters. I think that I did.
Yeah, I kind of feel like, I don't know why I didn't, though. Like, it's such a good movie. I don't know why I didn't have
it. Well, what year were you born?
87.
So it came out in... So you were two.
You were two when it came out.
Yeah.
That's why you didn't see it in theaters.
That's why you didn't see it in theaters.
Well, right, but I've owned the DVDs since the 2000s. It's not like I couldn't have had it on VHS. Like, you know, I had RoboCop on VHS, too.
We thought saying, why hadn't you seen it in theaters, not why hadn't you seen it.
No, Joe brought up theaters. I wasn't talking about theaters. I'm talking about playing it on loop. I mean, this is a movie that's right in my wheelhouse with the comedy and the time travel, and it's smart. I love that type of humor.
I think Bill and Ted have issues in terms of remaining in the pop cultural pantheon because of Wayne and Garth.
And, yeah, and they're very similar.
Yeah, they're very similar.
And I did grow up with Wayne's World and Wayne's World 2.
Right, and SNL had the muscle to keep Wayne and Garth around in a way that Bill and Ted didn't, especially because they were made by a studio that was on the edge of bankruptcy and,
right.
and has always kind of struggled. And so
you mean Bill and Ted?
The Bill and Ted
yeah.
studio. Orion. Always struggled.
They came back just in time for the third movie, didn't they?
Yeah. And
they just came back last year or something.
Where Wayne and Garth had SNL, and so they could always bring them, you know, they could always bring them back in one capacity or another if they wanted to, whether it was on an SNL reunion show or if Mike Myers or Dana Carvey guest hosts an episode of SNL and they'll bring them back. Like, so there's, they just stayed around and they do all those retrospective shows with SNL. So
right.
it's just a way that they can stay around in a way that Bill and Ted honestly couldn't. And it's interesting to see the creation of those characters because, you know, I think the first Bill and Ted opened in like February of 89. And I think the first Wayne and Garth sketch was in February of 89.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Do you think that Wayne and Garth lifted any of their dynamic from Bill and Ted, being that Bill and Ted technically came out first? It was the same weekend. SNL was the weekend of the Friday night Bill and Ted release. You know, I don't know if they would have seen it. Maybe there was an industry like a screen.
No, you could have. I mean, you got to think about it. They, I mean, sure, those skits are written like the Sunday or the Monday prior.
So they had trailers and stuff. I'm just saying, like, I wonder. I'm not saying they totally stole. I'm not trying to say like Mike Myers and Dana Carvey stole the characters. But I mean, it's the time period. That's a movie coming out. They're seeing trailers. Excellent party, you know.
I don't think they did. I think these two things happen to develop organically on parallel tracks. And
wow.
And because one, Garth, or not Garth, but Wayne as a character had existed since 1987. So
really? He did?
Yeah, so Mike Myers created Wayne for Canadian television and had been doing him since 1987. There was a thing called Wayne's Power Minute, I think it's called. If you go, it's on YouTube if you want to go look at it. But so there's footage of him and doing Wayne in 87. So the only real addition is that they added Garth cuz he needed someone to play off of.
And that's the dynamic is more what I'm thinking. I didn't say that's, I mean, they didn't steal the characters and I'm not insinuating they did. I'm saying that dynamic of the two of them, Bill and Ted is coming out. I wonder if Wayne and Garth is a response to that movie coming out at the same time. It just seems so strange that they're very
We've seen that before though, right? Like where two things kind of come out within like 6 months of each other.
Yeah.
And they just happen to be two little brain nuggets that kind of happen at the same time.
Ants and Bugs Life or
right
Armageddon and whatever that other
Deep Impact,
there we go. And I always think that's
Pierce Brosnan volcano movie.
You're right.
Dante's Peak and volcano.
Right,
so but I those mean, are two studios trying to get the competing hot topic out there or whatever. I just mean that's interesting that we know that SNL, they crunch all night. Like, I mean, they SNL skits, they all stay there and they like write all night the day before they go on air or the day before they rehearse or whatever. So like there's a very small window and I'm just thinking people are trying to pitch their stories and, you know, pitch their ideas for the show to Lorne and they're developing these and Mike Myers has the character of Wayne already and he's seeing trailers for Bill and Ted and it's like, well, Wayne and Garth, you know, I don't know.
I could see it being a situation of Mike Myers has Wayne as a character in his back pocket. He sees the commercials for Bill and Ted and he's right. like, ah, crap. Like this
yeah,
is
right.
This is very similar to a character that I created and I want to push it out there as quickly as possible so people know that I didn't steal it, you know?
Yeah.
And so here's another little interesting wrinkle to add to this who came first question, right?
Yeah.
So
ooh, all my stuff's wrinkly right now, so it's fine.
So we now know that Wayne pre-existed the release of Bill and Ted, right? He existed in 1987. So Bill and Ted was filmed in 1987 and shot and sat on the shelf for 2 years before it finally got released. So
well, there you go.
How do you disentangle who came first at this point? You know what
That's
I mean?
That's really interesting. But anyway, so they're set off on, they know that they have to ace this history presentation. They have to give a presentation about all these historical figures, and they're at the Circle K, which is another one of my favorite lines once Rufus shows up, and they're asking people about history questions, and it's just like they have no idea what to do.
They ask the gal, he's like, how long did Genghis Khan rule China? And she's like, I don't know. Like, yeah. I work at Circle K. I have no idea.
And he shows up. Rufus shows up in the phone booth.
Yep.
And he explains to them that they need that he's there to help them.
Right.
And
they're gonna change the world. The Wild Stallions with a Y is gonna change
two
the
Ys.
World. Two Ys, yeah, right, sorry. So they go to France and they get to see the beginning of Napoleon and his reign across France, and Napoleon accidentally gets sucked into the time loop and comes back to 1989 with Bill and Ted. And then they have to figure, it's almost like Avengers Endgame saw this premise and they're like, no, you just got to put them back. If we just put them back right where they go, we'll be okay. Here's the problem is, much like any time travel movie, you're Napoleon and Genghis Khan and Joan of all these characters are going to remember that they were in the future.
Sure.
So they're going to know. Like, but they're going to know everything.
This is a really great time to interject here with, none of this stuff matters.
Exactly. Exactly. And the premise of time travel is a ridiculous concept. And
this is a ridiculous
movie. This one is
movie.
Just like, no, we just picked him up in a phone booth and then we put him back at the end. It's
but
fine.
That's what's so great. I love it when a movie knows what it is and it can be silly and it can be totally preposterous and you don't have to think about it, right? It's movies today, and I mean there's always been movies that you have to think hard about, obviously, but it seems like today there are more serious movies, more movies that are really complex and there are twists and loops, and you know, Shyamalan and Nolan and all these movies that you have to really think about. And so to get a movie like Bill and Ted and then the sequels to where you can just watch it and it's silly and they time travel and it doesn't make sense and you love not having to worry about it.
You know, it doesn't have to make sense. You know, like we say, like we talk about it all the time with like Looper, where they're like, if I tried to explain it to you, your head would explode.
Well, because ultimately time travel, you can't explain it, right?
Like, no, you can't. It's impossible.
Any time travel movie is going to create ridiculous paradoxes, even if it has its own rules and follows them. By virtue of definition, you're going to create paradoxes. So there's
it depends. There's two theories, right?
So right, but each theory like creates its own paradoxes though that eventually you're gonna stumble over. So,
but you have smart time travel movies,
absolutely,
and you have I don't want to say Back to the Future is not smart, but you also can forgive Back to the Future because it's fun and zany,
right,
and sci-fi and whimsical and
it's
all that.
It's not there to really talk to you about time travel.
Yeah, basically, no. There's Primer and then there's Back to the Future, Bill and Ted, fun movies. Looper's even more serious than Bill and Ted. So I love that this movie, they go back and they do this stuff and they're going to put most of the people back. And you don't have to think about the consequences of what you've done because in theory, with this new knowledge, you're right, Joe. Like, if we were really thinking about this, they would completely screw up the past because they would know things, do things differently. They would change the whole, you know, but we don't worry about that in Bill and Ted.
When Abraham Lincoln jumps, when he's in, like, the theater background and somebody pops off, like, the picture, and he, like, startles. Yeah. And I was like, man, that's a joke that I didn't notice until just now. Like,
totally.
That's a hilarious joke. Yeah. The other running gag, that the fact that they continue it into the third one is amazing, is the stepmom.
Yeah.
Oh, sure.
I love it. Like, yeah. That's such a, when he's just like, remember when you tried to ask her to the prom? Shut up, Ted. Like, the fact that they bring her, the same woman, the same character, and bring her back for part three is insane and amazing. I loved it.
It is. So back to France. I'll tell you, the part in this movie on my first rewatch since, you know, that I watched on DVD, the part that made me realize I didn't have to think too hard about this movie is when they were in the chateau in France and they're trying to hide or whatever they're trying to do, and they put on the suits of armor and they walk around. Like, as soon as they were like, oh, I know what to do, and they cut to it, and they're in suits of armor. I thought to myself, you know how long it would take them and, yeah. to put on suits of armor, and you know how loud it would be and all this, but the fact that they just did a jump cut to them in full suits of armor, I'm like, right. oh, okay, this movie doesn't...
Well, also, they move like the Tin Man when they're fighting each other, yeah. right? Like, they just can't move, and then as soon as Ted falls down the steps and Bill thinks he's dead,
yeah,
like... Bill is sprinting down the steps with no problem yeah. whatsoever
like,
in that
oh,
suit.
Oh, this is heavy, but they're clearly not wearing armor that's heavy. Like, I mean, in the movie, maybe it's supposed to be, but when you see it, it's like half armor.
Right.
It's just a very costumey type. So,
it's hilarious.
So as soon as I saw that, I reminded myself, because I hadn't seen it in a while, I'm like, okay, that's what type of movie is this. You're there to have fun. You're there to check your brain. You're there to party and say excellent and be buddies and have this excellent adventure, and you're not there to pick it apart. You're not, you know, and it's really nice, especially as a critic, to be able to sit back and just enjoy something like that.
Right. No, and that's the thing is, like, the, I think you are absolutely correct, is that time travel movies, with the exception of Palm Springs, which is kind of a time travel movie, sort
sure.
of.
Yeah, I mean, it's a loop.
They just
yeah.
take themselves so seriously. Like, you just forget that time travel movies used to be fun. Well, maybe mm-hmm. that's a time machine. That wasn't fun, but...
yeah.
And it's that's like the first one. That's literally I know, right? the first time travel story. Anyway.
I love the Time Machine.
Time Machine's like, a great movie.
Both of them.
I don't even mind the remake, but I think I love that first one.
Oh, I love the remake. I love the first one. I love the remake. I love the book. Like that. I've said it before. That's why when we reviewed Project Almanac way back in the
garbage.
First 100
talk about
episodes,
taking themselves too seriously.
Yeah.
But I enjoyed it to a point. Like, I enjoyed it more than you guys, even though I didn't think it was a great movie. But I've always said, time travel, sign me up. Anything time travel, because The Time Machine is one of my favorite movies.
What about Superman flying around the Earth and turning it backwards?
Absolutely not. But I
that's
love...
where I draw the line.
I find it fascinating, like, how this movie takes this fantasy sci-fi premise, and it's just a delivery device for getting you Bill and Ted to be goofy, right? And
yeah.
I think it's really funny considering who Chris Matheson's father is. Do you know who his father is?
No,
no,
I never noticed.
His father is Richard Matheson. So
oh.
he, so yeah, like legendary.
Really?
Yeah, legendary author Richard Matheson is his father. So like his
I didn't
for people that don't know
that.
his father wrote the like 16 episodes of The Twilight Zone. He wrote Nightmare yeah. at 20,000 Feet, that episode. He wrote the story that Real Steel was based on. He wrote Stir of Echoes. He wrote the book that Somewhere in Time was based on. He wrote What Dreams May Come. He wrote The Shrinking Man.
What was the movie with Christopher Reeve and Jane Austen? Isn't that Somewhere in Time?
Yeah, that's Somewhere in Time. And
yeah,
then
okay.
What Dreams May Come was the Robin Williams movie.
Yeah.
He wrote the short story that was turned into the Steven Spielberg TV movie Duel. He wrote...
Good Lord.
He wrote I Am Legend.
That's the big one, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, I know him for is I Am Legend, which I love all those movies.
Yeah, he wrote the story Button Button about, which is the turn in the movie The Box, where it's like you get a button and it'll kill somebody if you hit it, but you get $1 million, blah, blah, blah. Like, I mean, so it's fascinating. Like, it almost is it almost feels like an act of rebellion to, like, I'm going to work in the genre that you work in, but I'm also not going to take it seriously in any way, shape, or form.
So they're basically just bouncing. The part of the project is they have to think about what these famous historical characters would think of San Dimas. So what Bill and Ted decide to do is they just go and get these famous people, right? Like, they go to the Wild West and get Billy the Kid, who is an actor who they're just like, can we get Bon Jovi? And they're like, no. Can we get a guy that looks like Bon Jovi, though? They're like, absolutely.
But isn't it interesting that these historical figures are who you picture of as the real people?
Yes.
Bill and Ted did the casting so well to where they resemble what you've seen in the history books and in some of the movies and things. Like, the casting in this movie in particular is done so well where it just works. And I like Billy the Kid. That's
Billy.
How I
think
Billy
of Bon Jovi when I think of Billy the Kid. I don't know why.
Because of Young Guns. That's why.
That's what it is, right? Yeah. Okay, that's what I thought that it was, but I didn't want to sound stupid.
Although
as
technically,
opposed to any other time on this podcast,
technically he's Young Guns 2. But
oh, yes. That's right. That's right.
Yeah,
but this guy looks very similar to Bon Jovi. And the guy, I was like, oh, they got not Bruce Dern to play Socrates.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
That guy looks just like a, you know, B-level Bruce Dern. The fact that he's giving the monologue that's basically going to turn into Days of Our Lives.
Which is another great joke.
Like, hilarious joke.
They say, all we are is dust in the wind, which is another great quote. And then he starts quoting, like that's, again, the zany, like the goofy nature of this movie is that Socrates, of all people, is then trying to be prolific. And then even in Greek, he's saying it in, I think there's subtitles, right?
Yeah.
And translate. And he's saying, like, sands through the hourglass, so are the days of our lives.
You know,
like,
one of the things I really like about this movie, for it not taking its time travel seriously, I love the fact that they didn't have these people that they picked up speak English. That,
yeah,
correct.
You know, that it would have been a really easy to just have them speak English with accents and never address it. And I always like the fact that, like, they don't speak the same language except for the princesses, which they pick up in medieval England, although that version of English would be so far removed from what we speak. Right. They would.
Did you recognize the one princess?
No.
She's the girl that from Better Off Dead. She's the girl that John Cusack is after. The French girl, yeah.
Oh, the French girl, not the girl breaks up.
No, the French, the exchange student. Okay. It's the same gal.
Gotcha.
But they don't bring her back for...
They're never played by the same actresses.
No, they're not.
They're always recast.
Right. But yeah, so they... And Abraham Lincoln obviously speaks English.
Right.
I love that
Although
scene.
They like, hardly have him talk.
I know. He's like, I'm gonna need that hat and fake beard. But he's like, no, it's mine. And he has to run away. But yeah, so they get Beethoven and Joan of Arc and Genghis Khan and Sigmund Freud. So they've got all of these, just a hodgepodge of random historical
people. It's all
people.
The people around the chalkboard in the beginning of the movie.
Which, you know, to the director's and writer's credit, it's like, oh, it's a little foreshadowing.
Fine. They were learning about all these historical figures in class.
Right.
And
that's what the class is
about. Yeah.
Yeah.
So they went back and they got them.
It's crazy because I feel like there's more to this plot of the first one than it really is. Like, it's just them going from time to time. They have to, like, the idea that if you just think about something in the present, you're like, no, I'll just put them behind the sign. And then they're there. Like, the most ridiculous aspect of time travel.
That's my favorite part of the whole movie. That
it's fantastic.
That just solution of, like, oh, okay, well, in the future, I'm just going to put the keys right there. Like, that's...
I was thinking about it, especially in the second one, and then they end up being smarter than I would have given them credit for, not to jump ahead, but... It's just Deus Ex Machina. It's crazy. They're like, how are we going to get them out of this? And it's like time travel in general is a huge Deus Ex Machina. When you can time travel, in theory, because the rules are so loose and there's so many interpretations, you can do whatever you want. And I love that they get them into a corner and they're like, oh, we'll just do this later. It's so cheap, but it's also in this movie, it's funny and endearing. Like, you know, we'd be so mad at a movie for doing that.
In a movie that was taking time travel seriously, we would be enraged. But
it would be so cheap, we'd be calling it a terrible movie.
Yeah, but in this movie, because it's not supposed to be, because they're these kind of like... I even hesitate to call them dumb, like, because you do see moments where they're really smart, but by and large, you know, they're not the smartest guys in the world. And so when they have these moments like this, and you're just like, it's so illogical that in this situation it makes perfect sense, and you're like, of course that's the solution they would land on.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm hesitant to call them dumb as much as they're just goofy.
Yeah,
like, they're just kind of like, meh, whatever, dude, let's play a guitar and try to get our way through school.
They're not dumb, they're just slackers.
And yeah,
they are,
you,
just slackers.
You
yeah.
see little moments where, like, they actually you see them be pretty smart, and then there's like a throwaway gag where Napoleon, when he's doing that water slide presentation at the end of the movie, and it's
yeah,
got all this,
yeah,
he's diagramming the Battle of Waterloo, which
that's hilarious,
which he will lose.
Right.
And And Ted looks up at it and says, I don't think it's going to work. And and Ted doesn't
and he
know.
He just smashes it.
We know that Ted is failing history, so Ted does not know the the battlefield logistics for the Battle of Waterloo, but he looked at it and instantly went, like, it's not going to work. So, I mean,
right.
He's not, you know, and I know it's also just a silly joke, but it does say something to his character that, like, maybe he's not as dumb as he as he comes off sometimes.
I think
know?
It's probably supposed to be just for a one-off joke, but I get what you're saying to read into it a little deeper.
But they could have given that line to any other character in the movie.
I will say Ted is, if there was a dumber one, Ted is the one that gives the most dumb answers. You know, like
Ted is the Shaggy of this duo.
Yeah, like
if this is Scooby-Doo, Ted is Shaggy, where he has moments of brilliance. But he doesn't do it, like, he's not doing it on purpose. He's kind of lucks into it.
As silly as both of them are, Ted is the one that you're just like, yeah, you may not be all there.
Which is also something that Wayne and Garth would do, right? Like, they'd have these moments where they would, where they'd all of a sudden say something incredibly smart and erudite, and you're just like, where did that come from?
Word.
And then they'd go right back into being these kind of faux stoners.
Right.
They get all the characters. I mean, the only conflict really is just trying to round all the characters up. And every time they go somewhere, it's like they get in danger. But then the other characters who they've rounded up will help them. Right. And they all become friends and they're all on the same team. Like, you just totally ignore the fact that these guys have been basically kidnapped and now they're traveling through time, but they become such quick, close friends. But that's what you love. Like when Socrates and Billy the Kid rescue.
I need a Socrates, Billy the Kid movie, like buddy cop movie.
But the fact that the two of them rescue Bill and Ted from being beheaded in medieval times because they think they're witches from their time travel, like from the future and all that, you know, like when they pull the robes off, they're about to execute them. And it's like such an awesome moment. And you're like, they just kidnapped them in the previous scene, but now they're friends.
Well,
they're
in all fairness, they don't kidnap Billy the Kid. Billy the Kid, like, befriends them.
Well, they save Billy the Kid, sure.
But they do.
But you get what I'm saying.
Kidnap Socrates.
Also, if you want to get out of there, they're your only hope.
That's true.
So even if you don't like them, I mean, if we really want to drill down on the logic of Bill and Ted, like, it, you know, that if Socrates and Billy the Kid want to get out of medieval England, they're going to need those two.
Right.
Oh my God. One of my other favorite lines is when they get out of the phone booth with all the people and they start renaming them.
That's Paul Socrates and that's Ben
that's Bob. That's Bob Genghis Khan. Like, see, that's the other thing is like Bill gives them smarter names. Bill covers up the part that you would actually need to cover up. And then Ted just adds something to the full name again, because that's how he's written. And they're both endearing, lovable, charming, great hearted, kind spirited people. It's not a knock on either of them. But Ted is the dumb one if you're going to pick one of them. And
can we act as this is a prequel to John Wick?
Yeah. Right.
Like he ends up going to military school.
Not based on the third Bill and Ted.
I know, it's true.
Well, alternate timelines, right? Like then there's a timeline where he gets a B on the history final.
And he has to go into
He has to go to military school.
And then that's why that the Escape from New York, Big Trouble in Little China comic is great because Jack Burton and Snake Plissken are the same person, just different timelines.
That's hilarious to think if Ted had to go to military school, he'd become John Wick. So, but yeah, I love that. I mean, we didn't say it earlier, but the there are strange things afoot at the Circle K. I think that line is brilliant. It's because it's so out of place. It's so strange for Ted to say something like that, like to speak that way.
I feel like that's another allusion to the fact that maybe he's not as dumb as you think. Because I'm trying to think, but he's got they have these other moments where they speak in this kind of ornate, flowery language that you wouldn't expect. And it just pops up every once in a while. Strange things are afoot at the Circle K.
It's a great line. That's a fantastic line.
Yeah.
On paper, that line, I love it. It's such a good line.
And it was funny watching it because I watched all three of these with my kids and they had a great time. They loved them. And it was funny because like there's a Circle K by our house. And so half the time when I drive by it, I'm like, strange things are afoot. And they were like, when watching this movie, they were like, oh, that's why you say that all the time.
there's a meaning to my madness every yes. once in a while.
Yes.
But yeah, so I mean, that's the premise of the movie, is they apparently had their presentation all set and ready to go, because they come out with lasers and smoke and
time travel. All they had to do was decide.
They set it up, remember?
Yeah.
Oh, that's right. I'm like, we'll do that later. And they get in. I do one of my one of the gags I've always remembered is the teacher, who, again, the only character who's a dick in this movie is Ted's dad. Mm-hmm. Like, even the teacher is not mean.
He wants them to succeed, but he can't give them the grade.
But he's like, I can't pass you. And then so they have to be there at 7:45, and he writes the F like on the paper, and then after the report, he just puts like a line.
Yeah.
And makes it an A.
The same way you'd fake a grade.
I gotta tell you, I've done that because of this movie.
And it doesn't work.
It doesn't work.
No. Because nobody makes an A with a flat top.
I know. Right. But you gotta like be really, if you could just like curve it a little bit.
See, maybe it's an overreach. If you get an F, you don't make it an A, you make it a B.
Say it, yeah.
Pa-caw! Yeah. Well,
I shot for the stars.
Yeah, it's an overreach, man. An F to a B, super easy.
Are you kidding me? My parents would be even excited if they were just like, well, I got a C.
Plus, in all honesty, they're going to question you getting a B a lot less than they're going to question you getting an A.
Yeah, that's true. They're like, well, let's be honest.
Yeah.
So it's great. The presentation is wonderful. Like, they come up with this amazing presentation right down to the wire when they're about to send everyone home early. But yeah, the lights, like you said, the music, the smoke, they come out, and it's, the brilliant writing here with each of the segments. Each of the historians comes out, and they're doing like a Sigmund Freud analysis. And Lincoln
about his dad.
Yeah, Lincoln comes out there. Billy the Kid shoots something, which obviously in modern eyes, you're just like, ugh.
A gun in a high school.
All the kids are like, oh, this is dumb. And then Billy the Kid starts shooting up at the light fixtures with his real gun. And they're all like, yeah, you know, like it's so weird. But each one of them has their own little segment, and they do this amazing presentation.
Yeah.
And it's a wonder. Like, I'll tell you what, talk about movies sticking the landing. All three of these movies,
they do
know how to stick the landing.
That they do.
I am
for sure
blown away by that, and obviously we'll get to them as we go on. But yeah, the endings of these movies make you feel so good and have such a good time and are fun and are heartfelt, where you're just like, it doesn't even matter any of the shortcomings before them, and not so much in this movie, but like with the other ones, you forget about the shortcomings by the time you get to the endings, because you're just like, I feel so good.
Yeah, they're just fun. Know? Like they don't take themselves too seriously. You are engaged with everybody in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Bill and Ted, I think, I don't know, man. Like, I do kind of think that they are timeless characters. I think those characters will stay around forever.
They're definitely an iconic duo of all the iconic duos. They're up there.
Yeah, that's kind of what I'm thinking, right? Like, like I said, in the 80s, they milked those two. And obviously in the cartoon, they were not voiced by Keanu Reeves and Alex Winter. But they did have a Saturday morning cartoon. Granted.
George Carlin did.
Did he? He came back for the cartoon?
George Carlin, they got all Rufus. Four. So the Saturday morning cartoon ran for two seasons. So the first season, they brought back all of the voices, the main,
including
people.
Keanu Reeves and
they
Alex
got,
Winter.
Yes, they got Keanu Reeves, they got Alex Winter, and they got George Carlin do the voices. They made, I think, 13, 16 of those, something like that. And then it switched production houses, and it went from Hanna-Barbera to DIC.
Yeah, Deke,
sure, let's call it Deke. Why would we call it Deke?
That's what they said. Yeah. That's how I remember.
Right, at the beginning of the cartoon. Did they do the Turtles, too? They were in lots of cartoons that I watched. I can't remember.
DIC did a lot of cartoons. Yeah, they did a lot. And it was normally a sign of it's going to be not good. So,
word to me.
when it switched production houses, then they switched voices. And so they made a very, very, very... 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Very short-lived live-action TV show.
Oh, really?
Yes. Called Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. And when they made that live-action show, then they used those actors to do the voices. So Keanu Reeves and Alex Winter and George Carlin went away, and they were replaced by two actors so inconsequential that their names aren't even clickable on Wikipedia.
Oh. Poor guys.
Sorry, guys.
I think they had a video game, too.
Yeah, I think there was a video game.
Oh, sure. Everything in the 80s and 90s had a video game.
Yeah, and then the George Carlin character was replaced by a stand-up comedian named Rick Overton, who, if you ever look at his IMDb, it's pretty fascinating because he's not a guy that you'll recognize, but he's a comedian who comedians love. So he pops up in a lot of great, great movies. Like, he plays, like, I think he plays one of, like, the rednecks in Groundhog's Day. And, I mean, he just does a lot of stuff, but he's never actually really kind of become, like, a quote-unquote name. But he plays Rufus. And then that lasted for, like, a season, and then the cartoon was done. So there's way more than you ever wanted to know about the Bill and Ted cartoon.
So at the end of the first movie, they do their presentation. They get the A that they need. So Ted is saved from military school. The two princesses become band members of Wild Stallions.
Well, yeah. Rufus snatches them from their timeline and then brings them to the 20th century. And there's like, here you go, boys.
Yeah.
Congratulations on that A. Here's
like,
your
talk about screwing up the timeline. Takes them, like, everyone else goes back and forget about the knowledge they have from the future, but he removes two people that maybe had some place.
Homer squished a mosquito in the prehistoric era and it changed everything.
Right.
Lord knows what it's like plucking two human beings out of time.
Right. So, but again, we don't think about that. And
no,
they
don't.
So they become part of Wild Stallions, and they start jamming at the end, and we remember they're terrible.
They're
musicians.
Awful. Yeah. That's the thing I love is that they're not good, and they know they're not good, but they don't care, and we don't care. Like, it's not like they miraculously become these amazing rock gods. They're just like, yeah, we suck. We're not good at this.
But at the end, when they're jamming, George Carlin turns to the camera and breaks the fourth wall and says, they do get better.
Yeah, right.
Because remember, the premise is they're supposed to save the world with their music.
Right.
Yeah, it's interesting, is especially in the second one, we'll set up the retconning that they do in the third one. Because, you know, just clearly they had there was a vision, and they kind of deviate that path in the next one.
Big time. So then we jump to 1991, and Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey is often... And this, like I said, this is the most wackadoo movie. I can't even...
This is a weird movie.
This is a weird movie. This is a very, like, I don't want to call it experimental, but it kind of is.
There are some things that feel kind of experimental, but as indie as the first one was, it still was way more mainstream than the stuff they do in this one. This one, you're just like, whoa. I mean, talk about the special effects and all the, I mean, I think this movie started off very strong and then it kind of got muddied. And I'm not saying I didn't enjoy it, but you can tell right away they've got this huge budget, and when they go to the future, they set up the Bill and Ted Institute or whatever, the Bill and Ted University, and you've got this huge futuristic setting. Everyone's in the futuristic costumes. You've got statues. You're like, wow, they're really going for it with this movie. And I loved the art direction. I mean, it's totally 90s future.
You know?
It's the future everybody in the 90s envisioned, so it's that style. But it's still very endearing, very creative, and they had a budget. Like, they went for it. And so I really loved how it started off. And then I feel like once they go on this journey they have to, I feel like it kind of gets muddied, but they still have a lot of miniatures and special effects, which are very dated now, but at the time, like early 90s,
when they go to hell, like, I still love that, the way that's set up. Like, the way they do the animation for hell and everything, I was like, yeah, this is what I remember.
Yeah.
And yeah, it doesn't... Sure. Obviously, this is done in 2020. That's... Well, we see. It's all CG, right? But back then, it was like a claymation almost, and I loved it.
Well, they did... It was a lot of computer effects. If it were practical, if it were stop motion, it would have been way better. This was computer for most of it. So, like, think about the them possessing the dad and, like,
those effects.
Stuff they were doing with computers, you could tell they were like, we've got this huge budget, computers are big, like, you know, there's all this stuff happening, like, we've got all these effects that no one's ever seen before. It's like getting a new It's like getting a new video editing software that comes with your,
what you can do with
comes
it.
With your Apple computer, and you're like, oh, I can do the wipe left and the crisscross checkerboards transition, and the like. They had all these toys to play with, and again, I'm not knocking them. It was a different time, but you could tell they had this toolbox now, and they're like, we can use computers. We'll have people walk through them, and they'll stretch and squish, and like, you know, they pulled out all the stops for the time and did every effect they could think of. But now you look back at it and you're like, yep, 90s.
Yeah, they went for it. They were doing their thing. So this one is a little bit different, where they are just now, they're just slackers. Like, I assume they're not, they've graduated high school, they're still trying to make it
it's 5 years later, I believe.
Okay, so they're living on their own,
because they mentioned something about 5 years in the movie. I didn't take notes but I remember them saying, like, we've been doing something for 5 years.
They're living on their own, but they're not working. They're still a very bad band.
They're aspiring musicians.
Sure they are. And they get entered into Battle of the Bands by Pam Grier, of all people.
Yeah.
I was like, whoa. And they realize that they have to win. Like, they're... much like their backs were against the wall with the History Project, if they don't win Battle of the Bands, again, Ted's dad's going to ship him off to Alaskan military school. Now, in this movie, Bill's mom or stepmom has left Bill's dad and has married Ted's dad.
Which is another great joke when you see her with Ted's dad. And Bill's like, hey, Missy. Oh, I mean, mom. And then she's making out with Ted's dad. And you're like, what? And then he's like, I can't believe that your mom divorced Missy divorced your dad and then married my dad. Which is great, the way they keep setting, like, they keep that running joke going.
The thing I forgot about the last one is that they kick Bill out of his room to, like, screw around in their room, and I was like, oh, what scumbag.
And they give him money or whatever, like,
yeah, he's like, why don't you get out of here? And I was like, why, go to your room.
That's
don't
so gross.
No,
yeah.
Way, that's gross,
right? Yeah, no, it's gross. But so the premise of this one, where I think they really lost the mainstream audience is they didn't time travel, except for, like, Bill and Ted don't really time travel in this one, where the first one is on this, the whole excellent adventure is them going through time, right? That's where all the jokes come. That's where all the great characters come through history. And this one, it's kicked off in the future, where the villain wants to, like, I really like the premise. Don't get me wrong. I love the setup that, yes, if Bill and Ted are these heroes and you have a villain, what's the villain going to want to do once he has time travel? Let's stop Bill and Ted from ever becoming the heroes and change civilization.
So, I love that he's a gym teacher.
Well, yeah, and that's the joke at the very
that's
end of
hilarious.
The movie. But Rufus is one of his pupils. They set it up like, this villain, Chuck Denomalous, is this evil villain, and he taught.
Do you know
Rufus.
Who he is, Kevin?
Who is he?
Lethal Weapon 2, Diplomatic Immunity.
This guy has a great voice.
Oh yeah, yeah, very much so.
So, but the way they set it up, where he's like, he's, you know, like, Rufus, my pupil, and he says, like, you're my teacher. They act like you're supposed to think that Chuck Denomalous taught Rufus everything he knows about time travel and all his advanced stuff. And spoilers, but jumping ahead, it's like, yeah, he was Rufus's gym teacher. So
what a great gag.
Yeah. So, and I love that they do. It's a very end reveal, but they. He wants to take out Bill and Ted, so he's created robot versions of each of them, and they're going all out again with the special effects, and I love the practical stuff where...
Man, when they pull the faces off, I was like, yeah, that would freak kids out. I could see where that would freak kids out big time.
That's a gag like the Beetlejuice gag.
Oh, totally. Absolutely, right.
And, you know, and this is in the same time period around, like, you know, Pee-wee's Big Adventure.
Well, no, what year was Beetlejuice?
Beetlejuice was 88.
Okay.
But Pee-wee's Big Adventure had the scares with the Large Marge.
Sure, Large Marge.
When you look at the art direction and the creepiness of this movie,
sure.
Reminds me a lot of Burton. A lot of Burton influence there. So, anyway, so the teacher wants to kill them so he can be... you know, so he can take over society. So you've got the great robot practical effects. I think when they pull their faces off, I think the masks are excellent, the way they look like their faces, and it's all practical. So they show them, like, putting their hands, the actors put the hands in the mouths, and then they cut and you see them taking the masks that look just like them over the robot props, and then they put them back on and they cut to them, the real actors putting their hands out of their mouth. So, you know, it's a really seamless transition, practical effect wise, and they do cool stuff there. And basically these two robots are going to go kill Bill and Ted and take their place
and then destroy their lives.
Yeah,
I think the big problem with this movie is the title, to be perfectly honest. I think this, so they originally wanted to call this movie Bill and Ted Go to Hell.
Mm-hmm. That would have made more sense.
And I think it would have also given the audience a better idea of what they were in for. Mm-hmm. And I think they were just worried, it sounds crazy now, but worried about having hell in a title back then.
Sure, sure.
And it is still a PG movie, right? Like, and so, which is interesting because PG-13 exists at this point, but this movie still gets a PG, which also says a lot about where the, you know, the slur that we talked about, where that was in people's minds at the time. It didn't even elevate this movie to a PG-13.
Yeah, you still get a PG rating.
Yeah, but
this movie with the themes would be PG-13 today. With the horror stuff, there's no way this would be PG.
Which is, which, like I said, when you see a PG movie before the invention of PG-13, and you're like, it's easy to go, oh, that would be a PG-13 movie today. But this movie exists well after the advent of PG-13, and they still didn't think it rated a PG-13.
I think it was just too new. I don't know. Because the thing is, the movie doesn't have the sex and the language that I think would necessitate a PG-13.
Yeah.
I think because it's scary and as the horror stuff today, once they kind of figured it out, I think it would be. But
I think also today they're more apt to give a movie a PG-13 because why not? It doesn't stop anybody from seeing the movie.
No.
And it prevents any potential complaints of, I saw this thing and it offended me. And then they can at least go, it's got a PG-13 on it. What'd you want?
Yeah, we warned you.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a suggestion. The PG-13, you're right. It lets people know what they're in for, and it's not stopping ticket sales. So I agree. But this one, I think that's the main detriment, though, is that you've got, it's a really interesting premise. I like it a lot. I like the idea of a villain now, because they've already saved, they've already set their future up to where they become the heroes. They've saved the day and gone back in history and done their thing. But now you have a villain's perspective and trying to stop them. That's really ingenious. But audiences were expecting more time travel adventures from Bill and Ted.
Right.
And in this one, they're just in the present day. And the only time travel really is them from the future, the robots coming back. And Rufus at the very end is able to throw his guitar on top of the phone booth as it's time traveling and hold on to the cable, the audio cable, and travel back. But he ends up being lost in the time circuit, supposedly, and that's why you don't see Rufus again until the end of the movie. But that's really
they had him for a day.
I think once you get over the idea that it's not going to be a time travel movie like you remembered the first one, it's easier to enjoy. But I really think we should talk a minute about, just to me, the highlight of this movie is the Grim Reaper. I mean,
William Sadler is the MVP of this movie.
He steals the movie and is absolutely great.
Sure.
The playing of the games when they deal is they have to get out of hell. They have to beat death in a game,
which is from this, for the real film nerds out there, that's from The Seventh Seal, the
correct
Ingmar Bergman film.
Right.
Well, yeah, even the way he talks. I mean, clearly, it's a parody of The Seventh Seal.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know how many average people get that. You know what I mean? But
sure, sure. So they play him in Battleship, and Bill and Ted win. And then he's just like, he's confounded. He can't believe that Bill and Ted just beat him in Battleship. And then he's like, 2 out of 3. And they're like, come on, fine. And then they beat him in
Twister, and they
Twister's the last one.
Yeah, Twister's the last one, yeah.
And but they're constantly beating. That's either when we talk about how maybe they're not as dumb as they show, where they're constantly beating death at all of these. And it's obviously they're not playing like, you know, sophisticated chess or checkers.
Well, they're not thinking games; they're kids' board games.
They're also games they would have grown up playing.
Right.
Right.
And right. Death expects them to pick chess.
Yeah. Battleship. And so Death becomes almost enamored with Bill and Ted in the most adorable way possible, where he's like a lost puppy.
Yeah.
Where he just wants to, he likes these guys now, and he just kind of wants to hang out with them. And he kind of becomes like their sidekick when they, like the scene in heaven, like they go to heaven in this movie and they talk to God. Like, it's just the most, when you say that Bill and Ted deal with death, and they deal with God, and all of a sudden they meet Standard, right? That's what it's called.
Station.
I don't understand the station thing.
Okay, so they go to God, right? And they say, "Look, we can't beat these robots. Can you help us? Give us a plan to.
We need an inventor that can help us design something that will beat these things." And so God gives them Station. And,
well, no, he gives them the directions on that little disc, like record. And then I guess somebody says the greatest scientific mind is down there.
Yeah. Right?
And like in heaven. So they just kind of walk around and they find these two aliens who are the greatest scientific minds in the universe. And they're not from Earth. And Death's like, "What do you think? They're from Earth?
Why would you think the greatest scientific minds are human? You have the whole universe to pull from."
But why does the rock guy in the beginning say Station and they all go Station? I don't get the Station thing. I thought that was totally.
It's like just the only word that they say. Like, it's just it's just a joke. Like, I don't think there's a.
Who's the rock guy that no one. Who's the famous musician rock guy that's in the beginning of the movie?
Faith
No More.
He goes Station, and they go Station.
Maybe they all know who Station is
because they're in the future, right? They already know how this is going to play out, and Station's going to save the day.
But yeah, but I mean, that's before there was any problem or anything. He just comes out of the phone booth going Station.
But well,
goes,
yeah, but time
yeah, but
travel.
He's from like, the future.
They're in the future,
so the whole thing with Station would have already happened in his time frame, in his timeline.
I don't think that's how this works.
I don't know what else it could be referring to.
Because it hadn't happened yet.
I guess the Faith No More guy isn't from the future, right? Because the
they
Bill
got
and
him
Ted
from...
Institute have implemented the way of teaching history is to go back into the past and pick up people from the past.
Just
and
like
bring
they
them
did.
To the future.
Yeah.
So the Faith No More guy wouldn't have known the Station thing yet.
See? And so when he comes out of the thing and goes, Station, I'm like, what the hell is Station? And then they kept saying it the whole movie. I'm like, there has to be a through line with Station.
Now I'm going to have to go look at the Faith No More catalog.
Right? It has to be something. It has Station. To be something from Faith No More that they then adopted into these characters, because he says it, and with me having no understanding of him or that word, I'm just like... I didn't get it, and I was hoping you guys could explain
Or maybe, since they bring Faith No More from the guy from Faith No More to the future, that he's the one that created the word Station.
Yeah, I don't know.
I blew your mind. I just blew it. I blew everybody's mind right there.
Yeah, in 1991, he appeared as Sir James Martin, head of Faith No More, and the Theological Center in the future. Martin's only lines in the film were Station, and what a... So it's like, yeah, I would like to, we'll have to research that more. I was thinking you guys maybe just knew it and I was missing something, but
no,
yeah, he says it first and I don't get how he would know that word, why he would say that word. It's weird.
Well, so either way, we go back to present day and evil Bill and Ted are just wreaking havoc on good Bill and Ted's life. They've broken up with the princesses.
Who they've
who
just
are
proposed
two completely,
to.
That's correct. Who are two completely different actresses.
They were celebrating their 521st birthday.
Correct. Which I thought was fantastic.
Yeah.
Evil Bill and Ted robots take them out to the cliffs and they push them off and they die. And that's where they end up going out of their bodies and they're wearing like gray paint and gray clothes, which I thought was a pretty clever practical effect for showing them being dead. And then that's where Death shows up and he does the, "You can play me in a game or else you'll be doomed for eternity." And they end up just giving him a wedgie and running away.
They do them. They pull a Melvin.
Yeah.
So they come back, and I do like that Bill pulls a worm out of his ear, and like Ted's like, "God, I feel like somebody's been pecking on my face." So they come back with, and somehow they've brought Station and Death back with them. And they go to like a local hardware store, and they give Station the Station is like these two little weird aliens. So they go to this hardware store and they get all of the supplies, and then Station in the most ridiculous thing I've ever seen. Like they get on either side of the parking lot and they run at each other. and then they make a big station. Like, they just,
it's gross. That practical effect is gross.
But it's like, he looks like Goro. Like, that's the suit that I think of from Mortal Kombat. Like, it's the same sound or whatever. They make fun of Station's butt, which I thought was funny. And so he builds two good robot Bill and Ted's, who are just who are obviously not as advanced looking as right. bad robot Bill and Ted.
They look like Rosie from the Jetsons with the Bill and Ted clothes on. Like, they're, yeah, right, like right, robot right. robots. Do you notice how much Kevin Smith pulls from Bill and Ted movies in his movies?
I didn't notice it until I watched this one.
That's what I'm saying. But when you go back, in the first one,
when you watch them back to back,
when Billy the Kid goes through the wall, that's Mallrats. Right.
No. It's Bill and Ted. Bill and Ted go through the wall.
Well, but they're when they're in the Billy the Kid and they crash through the wall into like a woman's dressing room.
Right.
That's Silent Bob going through into a dressing room.
It's not Joy Lauren Adams' boobs, but it's...
When you think about the performances at the end, that's like Jay and Silent Bob at the end when they...
Or hanging out in front of the Circle K.
Yeah, it's like Kevin Smith, because he would have grown up with these movies, right? In his wheelhouse. It's interesting to see how much inspiration they are on his movies.
What year was Slacker?
Oh, like 90 or something, 80, 90s, early,
okay,
that time period, yeah.
Yes, Kevin Smith pulled a lot from Bill and Ted.
It's interesting. Which
I think is very funny.
Yeah.
So they get to the Battle of the Bands, and evil Bill and Ted have the princesses tied up, and good Bill and Ted show back up with their robots, and just like, I love that evil Bill and Ted just kind of give up, and they're like, yeah, well, you got us, and they get blown up, like the good robots destroy them. And just what I think is funny is that they get to the Battle of the Bands and they still suck.
Yeah.
And they're just like, I got a better idea. So they I guess we should say does the bad guy show up before they look like ZZ Top or after?
I can't remember.
Either way, the bad guy shows back up, and they vanquish him as well. And they realize that they still suck. So they jump into the phone booth, and they go back in time, or to the future, I guess, and learn to play guitar. They come back, and all of a sudden, Bill looks like one of the guys from ZZ Top. And they both have... which I think is a great retcon when we get to it, is they've got little Bill and little Ted. Like, they've got two little babies.
If one didn't clearly look like a boy.
Well, I mean, I feel like they're babies, you know, like you can swing it. Like,
one clearly looks like it'd be, they should have been baby babies. And older with a head of hair. And you're like, that's a little boy. but it would have been clever if they could have like nailed it. But in theory, the way they did, it's interesting for sure.
Yeah.
But it's 18 months. They said they've been practicing for 18 months. They have kids.
Yeah. And they come out and
I thought they said 16.
I don't know. I thought
either
it was
way,
18,
they come back and they play a song and they win Battle of the Bands. And that's how, and like the movie,
Rufus?
The credits, Rufus shows back up as Pam Grier.
He unzips.
So I was like, well, all right. He unzips when she starts unzipping, I was like, well, I've seen plenty of Pam Grier movies and I know where this is going to go. But then it's George Carlin. I was like,
but Rufus is in this movie for what? Maybe 7 minutes of screen time?
I think you're being generous with that.
It's in the beginning, maybe 5 minutes and 2 minutes here. Like, that's it. He's just like, yeah, who did you think? Like, who else would let you in Battles of the Bands?
Right. You guys suck. Who would put you in this thing? And like the end credits roll with them playing together on the guitar. And that's how this one, that's how it ends. Like, it's
another,
I like the montage at the end of like everything that happens, like just of,
yeah,
with the band moving forward. And
mm-hmm. Yeah, I really like the newspaper articles. Like, they put them on Variety and whatever, Rolling Stone and the newspaper articles.
Was that a thing like to win? Was that ever a thing to like win a battle? Like, that level of a Battle of the Bands was like the rocket ship for a band.
No,
I didn't think that was ever a thing.
I mean, it's always been a plot device in movies, but I mean, but you have had talent show type TV shows over the years. I mean, you know, like we had American Idol before that, Star Search.
I guess those are like Battle of the Bands. I guess that's true.
They're a form of that. I mean, even in the 50s, you had the Arthur Godfrey talent show or whatever, and that's right. Like that's where that's what launched Pat Boone. So I mean, you know, but it wasn't necessarily even winning it. It was more just like you get exposure. So there, I mean, as we've seen with American Idol, right? There's a lot of people that went on to very successful careers that didn't necessarily win.
Jennifer I don't think you want to win.
Chris Daughtry.
Yeah.
What's that?
I think you don't want to win. Like that's kind of it's the winner's curse. It's the guy that comes in second place that usually has the bigger career.
Well, especially with American Idol, people started figuring out you were better off to not win because if you won, you were contractually obligated to release your album and they controlled your career, where they didn't have a piece of Jennifer Hudson because she didn't win. And I think they controlled the top two originally, and then after that happened to them, they amended it to where it's like, well, now we get control of the top five.
Mm-hmm. Is it Carrie Underwood and who?
Bo Bice.
Who was the other one?
Daughtry.
Who's the first one? Who won the first one?
Kelly Clarkson.
Those are the two big ones, right?
I mean,
Kelly Clarkson and Carrie Underwood
have had the biggest careers.
Yeah,
Daughtry had a moment. Now he's more of a club play, casinos probably, but Jennifer Hudson.
Who's the guy who's front and queen?
Adam Lambert.
Well, that's a pretty big move.
I mean, yeah. I mean, when Queen takes him out, he can sell 30,000 tickets a night. But beyond that, he's pretty much a club play as well. Maybe small theaters. It's Fantasia still does real business.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so that's how this one ends.
It's a really fun, heartfelt, endearing ending. Again, these guys know how to stick the landing.
Yeah.
And as weird and tonally different as it is from the first one, and it may catch you off guard, they do some really interesting, creative things. And once you know that and accept it, like Tom said, I think it's a little bit easier and you can enjoy it more. And then you get to that ending and they're rocking out and having a good time. And the princesses are back with them because they realize it was the evil robots that were bad. And they have kids and a family. Like, it's just, they just end on a very happy, good energy note to where
it's a fun, loving movie.
Yeah, you leave having a good time.
Yeah. And I will say, I was lucky enough to get the Shout Factory did a Shout Select that has 1 and 2 on it, and that actually just went out of print, and it's like a $70 to $80 Blu-ray thing now. But that's the best version of these movies I've ever seen. Like, there's all kinds of special features and great stuff on there. If you want to shell the cash, I do recommend that set. Like, that's the set.
I would wait for the third one to come out on Blu-ray first. I mean, it's so close.
Oh, sure,
now.
Sure, sure. Why, I'm sure, you know, I'm sure Shout Factory will push it back out there at some point, but it's a fantastic set.
Yeah. So, I will say the biggest shock to me with this one, because I hadn't seen it since I got the DVD, it's been almost 20 years or whatever, was how creepy the hell scenes were.
Yeah.
You know? Ted is seeing his grandma that used to try to kiss him, and he's dressed up in all the prosthetics, which are really well done, and she's trying to come at him, and Bill is scared of the Easter Bunny because he used to steal his little brother's Easter basket. And they are these very, like I was saying earlier,
it's very Nightmare on Elm Street.
Tim Burton inspired, like the visuals looked very Burton-esque and very creepy, and like it had elements where you felt like you were watching a horror movie.
Mm-hmm.
Which this is just a PG Bill and Ted movie, but man, those scenes were creepy.
So good.
So I want to wrap up on just an interesting anecdote. Maybe that's not the best way to preface this, but just a fascinating little story. So on July 5th, 1978, a man by the name of Robert Alton Harris and his younger brother, they stole a car that was occupied by two 16-year-old boys. This story is going to take a dark turn before we circle back around.
Okay.
Ordered them to drive to a remote area that killed them both. The brothers then used that car as a getaway car, robbed a bank. They were arrested less than an hour after the robbery and charged with the murder, auto theft, kidnapping, burglary, bank robbery. One of the arresting officers, this is really sad, Steve Baker, was the father of one of the murdered boys but didn't realize it until later. Harris convicted, sentenced to death on March 19 in 79, right? You know how death row goes, takes forever. He finally is put to death in 1992. They ask him if he has any last words, and those last words whether you're a king or a little sweet street sweeper, sooner or later you dance with the reaper. He quoted Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey before.
That's before gross.
Yeah, I know, right? Like,
why are we ending on this note?
I just thought it was an interesting story.
It's,
so
it's a
I
great line.
It.
Like, that's a great line from the Reaper. Like, that's I love that line. But
it's such a great
like,
line when he
what
says
what a
it,
weird thing to
I
be
know,
the last
right?
Will and Testament is.
Yeah, like
quoting Bill and Ted.
I just thought it was a fascinating little side avenue. So
thanks.
No problem. That's what I do.
But no, I if you haven't seen these, I recommend them for your kids. Like, this is totally worth it.
Some people like the second one more than the first. I can't get behind that, but I think it's an interesting movie, certainly.
The death stuff is great. And anytime death is on screen, it's great.
I think they just... As much as, I mean, I did enjoy how weird and wacky it was, to me it felt like the hell stuff was a little meandering. Like, they got them to hell, and they didn't really know how to fill the time. It was a lot of very drawn-out scenes. And the jokes were good when they hit, but it was a lot of just, like, seeing them in hell and, like, the drill sergeant things. I'm like, I don't care. This is getting boring. Like, it meandered in hell. I liked the stuff before, and I liked the stuff after, especially when they get the Reaper. But until the Reaper comes, that whole hell thing is just kind of like
super creepy. It's very Nightmare on Elm Street. Like, there's a in Nightmare on Elm Street 2, there's the gym teacher, I think, is the same actor.
Okay,
maybe not, but if it's not, it's like, can we get a guy that looks like that guy?
Yeah.
But yeah, it's very creepy. So there you go, Bill and Ted 1 and 2.
There we go. I guess that's it for this one. Let's go around the table and everyone can say where to find them.
This is Joe. You can follow me on the Twitter at joeybutts, BUTTS 21.
This is Kevin. Follow me on Twitter at Kevin R. Brackett.
And this is Tom. You can follow me on Twitter at Roger Kubert or on Facebook at Facebook.com/Tom O'Keefe. You can find the show online, Facebook.com/Real Spoilers. While you're there, like the page, join the group, and of course, check out our Patreon, where for $5 a month you get all sorts of bonus content and you help out, and we appreciate it. So that's it for this one. Coming up on the next one, we will tackle Bill and Ted Face the Music. Until then, Lou stays in 1986.
I'm Bill S. Preston, Esquire.
And I'm Ted.
Bill, here, let me take it.
Okay.
And I'm Ted Theodore Logan.
Yeah!
And we're Wild Stallions!
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.